The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Welcome back to Mr. Harold's Music Class. We used to celebrate Columbus Day, but now we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. First off, let's define indigenous, the native people, original inhabitants. Living on every single continent, then somebody shows up and says, I discovered it. How can you discover somewhere already found, or take credit for a place that's already around, like Hernan Cortez or Hernando de Soto, Ponce de Leon or Francisco Pizarro? It all started with Christopher Columbus, Europe's obsession with Western discovering, with big dreams, it's while an Italian was searching for gold in the East Indies Islands. Long ago, 1492, we all know the story, he sailed the ocean blue. But here's what I didn't learn in school. After landing in the Bahamas, he treated people cruel. The Tainos are peaceful people in Cuba, Haiti, DR, Jamaica, Puerto Rico. Even though they welcomed him with open arms, he committed genocide and unspeakable evil. I wish that's where the story ends, but colonization is a sickness that spreads. Speaking of sickness, literal diseases, smallpox, chickenpox, and the measles. I wonder how history would change if explorers were peaceful when they came, learned native customs, cultural exchange, didn't force religion, and no one was enslaved. Aztecs, Incas might have lived longer from South America to Canadian borders, Cherokee, Sioux, Apache, and Navajo, Iroquois, Chippewa, Choctaw, Pueblo. The list goes on, so many tribes, so many stories, so many lives. Show love to the indigenous ones, from ancestors to those still alive. Sing!
One earth, one people, one love. 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 One earth, one people, one love.
So thank you for watching Mr. Harold's Music Class. Until next time, peace, love, and shabam.
So now I'm going.
One earth, one people, one love, right? This refrain is so simple, but so very, very difficult, right? Our culture, our history, our identities, our differences all build up division. They build up separation. And it's easy to think of those inside our group and those outside our group, whatever that group is, right? Age, sex, gender, sport team affiliation, physical appearance, family background, political persuasion, especially currently. All these categories which we put ourselves and others in that create a sense of belonging also create a sense of otherness. So what if we were one earth, one people, with one love? Here at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we strive for promoting unity, for promoting a shared love. So this congregation's vision statement begins, "We seek to be a caring, growing, inclusive, spiritual congregation promoting tolerance and understanding." That's something I want to be part of, right? I want to be part of a caring community which promotes understanding. And that's one of the reasons that we are here this and every Sunday morning. Our congregation exists in order to help heal the world, to create opportunities for personal, for communal growth, to open up the doors to transformation. Transformation in our hearts, so we can open up the doors to transformation in the world for one people and one sharing love. I'm Reverend Andrew L. Weber, and I'm so happy to welcome you here today. I'm a minister of ministers, a seeker among seekers, a guide among guides. We come together to share our truths, to find comfort from others, and to experience challenge from others. Welcome to this religious home where your truth is just as important as the person's truth next to you. Welcome to this community where we expect you to be your authentic self, living in covenant with others whom we expect to be their authentic selves. Welcome to this congregation where you are expected to make mistakes, to grow and to change. Welcome to this fellowship made hallowed and created by your presence and your intention this morning. Each Sunday, we join with Unitarian Universalists around the globe, not just across our country, around the globe, in lighting a chalice, the symbol of our ever-evolving and free faith. I'm going to share a reading, and then I've asked the Enright family to come forward to light the chalice. And I know that some of them take stuff in better visually or orally. That's also by your ear, dispelled differently, sounding the same. If you take it better in through listening, then listen. If you want to read, the reading I'm going to share is in the hymnal, and the hymnals are back there. If you want to go grab a hymnal, it's 652. It's one of my favorite readings. 652, The Great End in Religious Instruction, which was written by William Ellery Channing about youth religious instruction, but I think it can be generalized to everyone. The great end in religious instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. Not to make them see with our eyes, but to look inquiringly and steadily with their own. Not to give them a definite amount of knowledge, but to inspire a fervent love of truth. Not to form an outward regularity, but to touch inward springs. Not to bind them by ineradicable prejudices to our particular sect or peculiar notions, but to prepare them for impartial, conscientious judging of whatever subjects may be offered to their decision. Not to burden the memory, but to quicken and strengthen the power of thought. Not to impose religion upon them in the form of arbitrary rules, but to awaken the conscience, the moral discernment. In a word, the great end in religious instruction is to awaken the soul, to excite and cherish spiritual life. At Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we light a second flame each week, acknowledging the need for peace in our hearts, the need for peace in our communities, the need for peace in the world. Please respond with the words on the screen. May peace be with us
and with all the people of the world.
Thank you, Enrights. We're now joining in singing. Again, hymnals are still in the back if you want one. The lyrics will be on the screen. Feel free to please rise in body or in spirit. It's number 69. We sing now together.
We sing now together our songs of thanksgiving, rejoicing in good. The ages have brought, for life that enfolds us and helps and heals and holds us and leads beyond the goals which our forebears once sought. We sing of the freedoms which martyrs and heroes have won by their labor, their sorrow. See you.
Who had a day off work on Monday or a day off school on Monday? A couple people, especially if you're federal, you would have. If you're retired, I guess, yes. If you're retired, you would also. Or who noticed that you didn't get mail on Monday? Yeah, you didn't get mail. Yeah, maybe Amazon maybe still delivered, but there was no federal mail on Monday. And that's because the second Monday in October is a federal holiday, one of the 11 federal holidays. Who knows which one? Well, that actually, indigenous people's day, but the holiday is Columbus Day, yes. And we'll talk a lot about that today, don't worry. That's part of my topic, but it's Columbus Day. It was on Monday. Holiday, which has more recently been replaced by Indigenous Peoples Day. And I went to a few libraries through Delaware. It's not a big state, so I was, you know, going around to a couple libraries. Didn't take me that long. Because I wanted to get some books to introduce the holidays, but frankly, I wasn't impressed. I got these books and I was like, well, they didn't really touch on it that well, but I did find a good video, which I thought has a good explanation. It's from the explanatory journalism website, Vox. And I vetted this video with my 10-year-old son, and I was happily surprised that although much of what is covered was not part of my education, when we watched it together, he said, oh yeah, we talked about this. Yeah, we talked about this. So. Please enjoy this introductory video. You may, of course, come forward if you want, or watch it from where you are.
Christopher Columbus is all over America. There are statues in his honor, streets and cities are named after him. He's got his own national holiday, complete with parades. For centuries, Columbus has been celebrated as the brave explorer who discovered the New World.
We celebrate Columbus Day, the anniversary of that day in 1492, when Columbus first sighted the land of the New World, America.
But Columbus never even set foot on North American soil. His four voyages brought him to the modern-day Caribbean islands, Central and South America, but never to the country where more than 50 cities, towns, and counties bear his name. We rarely hear about the other explorers, who actually landed in the US just a couple decades after Columbus. So how did a man who never even set foot in North America end up with a national holiday and a permanent place in American mythology? Columbus and his arrival in the Americas is mostly introduced to kids through books, songs, or cartoons like this one.
I will discover a shortcut to India and bring back some of the great wealth I find there. And I can do it, for I know the world is round.
One of the many problems with cartoons like this one is that it taught a lot of wrong information. Children were told that Columbus defied conventional wisdom and proved the world was round. But at the time, people already knew the Earth was round. Columbus actually claimed the world was smaller than predicted, and he was wrong. Children were also told that Columbus's voyages to the inhabited islands in the Americas were peaceful.
The people Columbus called Indians were very friendly, and they gave Columbus and his men many gifts.
But they don't mention that Columbus and his men were responsible for the mass deaths of native people. A friar who lived on the islands Columbus reached and experienced the brutality of the conquest wrote about it. He wrote, "They forced their way into settlements, slaughtering small children, old men, and pregnant women." These details have been kept out of most textbooks from the beginning, allowing Columbus to become an American icon. The idealized version of Columbus is as old as the United States. It all began during the War of Independence when the US fought the British. The new nation needed a rebellious, non-British symbol, and they found one in Columbus. Once the US won independence, streets and cities were named after him. Columbus's iconic status was further cemented in 1828 when Washington Irving published a biography glorifying him. He described him as brave, heroic, and a genius, but he neglected to mention his brutal treatment of indigenous people. But Columbus's real big break came in the late 1800s, when the country he'd never visited started experiencing some massive changes. Italian immigrants were arriving in the United States in big numbers, and they faced harsh discrimination. They were treated as perpetual foreigners and restricted to manual labor. Their Catholic beliefs opened the door for even more discrimination, so they embraced Columbus. After all, he was Italian and Catholic and already admired. So he quickly became an icon for Italian immigrants who argued that they too belonged in America. On the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in 1892, Columbus Day was first brought into the school system. Schools held celebrations and students pledged allegiance to the flag for the first time, associating Columbus with patriotism in classrooms across America. A year later, Columbus became the theme of the World Expo in Chicago, branding him America's hero around the world. As Columbus and his legend became further embedded in American culture, so did the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic social club founded by Italian immigrants. By 1937, the Knights of Columbus had gained enough influence to convince President Roosevelt to proclaim Columbus Day a federal holiday. But not everyone wanted to celebrate Columbus. While the myth of Columbus had been developing throughout history, Native Americans in the U.S. had been dealing with destruction and discrimination for centuries at the hands of all the European settlers that followed Columbus. But in the 60s, things started changing in America. As the civil rights movement demanded change, Native rights became a part of the conversation.
We've asked the government for hundreds of years to do things for our people or with our people. The government has only compromised, only given us token issues to deal with. We're here today as living factors of the problem that are still existing.
Historians started re-examining Columbus and his story, correcting the myth and including the missing historical facts. As revelations about Columbus have become mainstream, some people have rejected the holiday, as well as the man and the legacy behind it. Today, cities around the U.S. are opting out of celebrating Columbus Day. In some cities, they are choosing to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead. At the same time, more than half of Americans think celebrating Columbus Day is a good idea, according to a poll commissioned by the Knights of Columbus. Most countries are formed with the help of myths and heroes to forge a sense of unity and belonging. It's human nature. But as the myth of Columbus is confronted with brutal historical facts, the U.S. will have to decide which myths are worth keeping and which ones to discard.
So hopefully that intro sparked some ideas and some maybe questions. And for those of you who are headed off to classrooms, ask your parents, ask your grandparents, your teachers, older family members, what they learned about Columbus Day and how it might be different from what you're learning about Columbus Day. Let us sing now the children's recessional hymn. Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the love of God surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. I keep switching this. It goes back and forth. Spirit of God, love of God. Yeah. Now, I found it very interesting to learn about culture through libraries. And I don't mean going to the library and studying society. I actually mean going to the library and looking about what is available, especially for children. What's there? And it's really telling reading about things like Columbus Day and seeing what's included and what might be glossed over or ignored entirely. And here's a brief overview of what I found about Columbus, especially about the people whom he encountered when he came here on his voyages, or general here to the Americas, in these children books, which I got from the library, which I decided not to share this morning. I'll show you what my insights, although not entirely. The stories have similarities. In each, we are told that Columbus named the people he met Indians because he thought he had reached the Indies. And it's usually portrayed in a somewhat humorous way, noting that Columbus made a mistake in his geography. And nowhere does it go into the appalling dehumanization The appalling arrogance of this error, right? The dehumanization of ignoring an individual's worthiness and personhood, the arrogance of labeling many groups by his limited understanding instead of by their own identity. Saying, I know who you are. Depending on publication date and grade level, and if you're really interested, come up, check these out after the service. But depending on publication date and grade level, it's a little bit different. Some of the picture books say that Columbus was cruel. That's about it. Or mention that Europeans and natives fought. And others only mention that they were friendly interactions, like the video that you saw shown to school children where the natives came and they gave him little potted plants, which has all sorts of anachronistic issues there. Now, over the three libraries, I only found one book on Indigenous Peoples Day, which is right here. This is for children. I mean, I was limiting it to like children's picture books, but there was only one on Indigenous Peoples Day, and it was seriously disappointing. Although this is written for a very young audience, so take that into context. There is no reference to Columbus Day, to the holiday supplanting, and the only mention of injustice is, "Let us remember the past. Let us work for better days to come." Okay, that's not false. Now, what I see is that even through the discussion about Columbus Day versus Indigenous Peoples Day, even though the discussion started in 1977, I didn't know that. It started 1977. There's a long way to go. Now, I'm not going to get up here and promote the replacement or promote the dismissal of Columbus Day. What I'm going to do, though, is talk about how we view our history. Because I think viewing our history must be one of both reverence and critique. Whether from my schooling, my parents, my culture, my peers, I grew up knowing that Christopher Columbus found our country in 1492. He had a great time with the Indians. And then sometime later, pilgrims arrived and they had a big feast. I mean, that's what I remember learning. Right? That was about it, right? And everyone was happy. I knew very little about the people native to this land. Nor did I understand the atrocities which happened both purposefully and inadvertently. Now, the problem with how we commemorate the holiday can be seen in this well-known adage, right, that history is written by the victor. Who gets to say what happened in 1492? Well, not the people who were killed, right? They weren't around to tell their story. An overarching concern is that if all of our history, if all of our stories and our facts are written by the victors, then are we only getting one side of any story, of any history? Yeah, a little bit. The National Museum on the American Indian, this is the Smithsonian Institute Museum, they have a page about, quote, unlearning Columbus Day myths, which has some really good information. Listen to what they have to say about this holiday. Many students learn the phrase, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But, right, I mean, we know that, the beginning of the poem. But Columbus was not the first foreign explorer to land in the Americas. Neither he nor those that came before him discovered America because indigenous peoples have been here, have populated the Western Hemisphere for tens of thousands of years. European contact resulted in devastating loss of life, disruption of tradition, and enormous loss of lands for indigenous peoples in the Americas. It is estimated that in the 130 years following first contact, Native America lost 95% of its population. Indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere immediately experienced enslavement and theft of resources by the explorers turned settlers. Colonies created by the Portuguese, Spanish, French, Dutch, English grew throughout the Americas and increasingly encroached upon native lands and lives. Warfare, enslavement, forced relocation, disrupted, altered the lives of indigenous peoples in the Americas. And celebrating Columbus and other explorers like him dismisses the devastating losses experienced by indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere in the past and the ongoing effects of colonialism today. Indigenous peoples are still here. Contemporary Native Americans have led numerous movements to advocate for their own rights. Native people continue to fight to maintain the integrity and viability of Indigenous societies. American Indian history is one of cultural persistence, creative adaptation, renewal, resilience. Native peoples, students, and allies are responsible for official celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day in some states. And it's celebrated on the second Monday in October and recognizes the resiliency and the diversity of Indigenous peoples in the United States. Now, another strange piece I find in this historical puzzle is that any discussion about re-examining history, right, any discussion about re-examining history can get political and can get emotional, right? I mean, you talk about this with some people and it gets very, very anxiety-ridden, very high feelings. People have strong feelings about what they know to be true. Tempers rise when change is on the horizon, right? There are people who want to tear down statues and rename schools and other things so that our country gives less clout to those people who committed the atrocities. And balance that with these other group of people who push against the quote woke culture and don't want their history or their values to be erased by liberalism. One group wants to get rid of a statue of the slave owner Thomas Jefferson, while another group feels that to be highly offensive to get rid of Thomas Jefferson, a founder of our country. The Confederate flag continues to be a symbol which to many means oppression, means violence and hatred, while to others means family gatherings and Southern pride. Now, I don't think it's helpful to create more divisions, but I do think it's necessary to view history with both reverence and critique. And I want to bring it closer to us. I was like doing this, like start broad and then get closer. I'm going to get a little bit more uncomfortable maybe. So let's look at our own history. Let's bring the conversation sort of closer to home. The hymn number 145, which I spoke about, and as always, you always get up, grab a hymnal, you're like, what is he talking about? What is it? This is As Tranquil Streams, the one that's referenced in the blurb to the service. It was written in 1933. It's 145 if you're looking. Before the consolidation of the Unitarians and the Universalists in 1961. There's a little faith history. Two religious organizations come together to create something new. Create something new, grounded in two histories and looking forward to a shared future. The vision written about in the hymn is about streams meeting and merging, creating a future together, right? I mean, how is that shaped up? Well, there are still divisions in our faith, albeit maybe not along the exact same lines as those original Unitarian versus Universalist divisions. But just as with our country, when history was written by the quote victorious, sometimes divisions are ignored. Who here, and some of you may, know about Unitarian Universalists' history with social justice, with racial justice specifically? All right, a little bit, yeah. If not direct knowledge, maybe you have an idea of like, well, yeah, what we've been doing. I mean, I grew up in this faith. I should know. I was taught that our faith has been at the forefront of racial justice, leaders in civil rights movement, always pushing for more equality and a goal of complete justice and liberation. Does that sound, I mean, that sounds right, right? That's Unitarian Universalism. I mean, if you don't know, you can see where I'm going here. It's like, well, hold on, Andrew's laying a trap for us. Yes, a little bit. Yeah, I am. He's not entirely, because think about when our religion went through this big change, what else was going on? This was 1961, so what else, apart from Unitarians and Universalists joining, happened in the early 1960s in the United States? The Civil Rights Movement, right? Civil Rights Movement, okay, so that's great. We were poised as a religious organization, we're poised and energized to lead the country into liberating love for people of color. Well, maybe not so much. is I have for you a few excerpts from a religious education handout titled The Empowerment Controversy. This is like getting into the deep history of Unitarian Universalism, but The Empowerment Controversy. And I'm going to go back and forth between quoting and paraphrasing because it was quite long. The involvement of Unitarian Universalist clergy and lay people in the series of civil rights marches in and between Selma and Montgomery, Alabama in 1965 is often regarded as a high point in Unitarian Universalist social justice efforts. During this time, three people were killed by white supremacists. Jimmy Lee Jackson, a young African American, was shot defending his family from the Alabama State Police. The two others, Viola Liuzzo and the Reverend James Reeb, were both white Unitarian Universalists who were participating in the marchers after Jackson's death. Reeb's assassination is credited by many with drawing national attention to the struggle for voting rights and prompting passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Sadly, the death of a white person had to bring that to our attention. President Lyndon Johnson sent yellow roses to Reeb's hospital room, and Martin Luther King Jr. preached Reeb's eulogy. King's eulogy summed up the vision of the integrationalist arm of the civil rights movement. In his words, he was a witness to the truth that men of different races and classes might live, eat, and work together as brothers. That vision was tested over the next decade within the Unitarian Universalist Association in what has become known as the Empowerment Controversy. In 1967, there was an emergency conference on the Unitarian Universalist response to the rising violent protests and riots which were happening across the United States. This is just like Unitarian Universalists. Let's have an emergency conference. Everyone get together and talk about it. Shortly after starting, the majority of black attendees withdrew to form the Black Unitarian Universalist Caucus, or BUUC. Right away, this movement was criticized, as you may see parallels to what has happened or what can happen currently. Some calling this new group one of separation and reverse racism. Right? The Black UU Caucus demanded that the larger conference adopt a series of proposals calling for African American representation on the Board of Trustees, on leadership committees, subsidies for Black ministers, and they also called for the creation of a Black Affairs Council, that's BAC, Black Affairs Council, with national UUA support of $250,000 a year for 4 years, which amounts to $1 million. These proposals were rejected, except for the creation of the Black Affairs Council with no promise of funding. The Black Caucus chairperson charged that the board's refusal to fund the BAC and the refusal to allow the BAC to control such funding directly reflected a traditional racist and paternalistic approach to black problems. In 1968, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. It was shortly before General Assembly, which is the national gathering of Unitarian Universalists. There was more push to fund the Black Action Council, and a general vote at the national meeting passed a motion to fund that organization. Now the quotes swing to the positive, with one noting that this kind of support gave the nation its first example of a denomination making a significant reparational response to the conditions of racism in America. Sadly, though, this was not to be the case in the long run. The UUA, I mean, we see parallels if you have interacted with the UUA on a national scale. The UUA had financial problems, and the board tried to alter the financial obligations that they had agreed to the Black Affairs Council. And the 1969 GA in Boston, things came to a head. I mean, the intersection of like politics, meetings, and like really deep feelings and social justice. The official agenda placed the vote on the funding of the BAC near the very end of the meeting. Members and supporters of BAC felt that this was not in keeping with the urgency of the issue, and they moved that it be placed at the beginning of the agenda. Oh my gosh, they're arguing about the agenda. Who here has heard, right? The vote to alter the agenda received a simple majority, but did not reach the two-thirds majority required for an agenda change. In response, chairperson declared, unless the assembly agrees to deal with these basic problems now and not next Wednesday, the microphones will be possessed and the business of this house will come to halt. Sure enough, the floor microphones were seized by BAC supporters and the business session was forced to end with nothing resolved. The next day, a motion was made to reconsider the order of the agenda. That motion lost. The Black Unitarian Universalist Caucus members quietly walked out. And after talking with leaders of the BUUC, Reverend Jack Mendelson addressed the assembly stating, our Black delegates have now left the room. They have left this assembly and they have left our movement because life and time are short. The assembly returning to business as usual and to the position of Black people at the back of the bus. Mendelson invited those who shared his feelings to join him down the street at the Arlington Street congregation where he was minister. A few months later, the board, the UUA board, faced with the ongoing fiscal crisis, with their own legal responsibility for the financial well-being of the institution, voted to reduce what they were going to pay to the Black Caucus and spread it over a different number of years. The Black Action Committee members decided to disaffiliate from the UUA and attempted to fundraise on their own. Now, despite an initial success at fundraising, the BAC, beset by internal strife, differences in strategy, direction, loyalties, slowly faded from the Unitarian Universalist scene. Many of its members left Unitarian Universalism altogether. And not until 1979 did the UUA begin to explore what had happened and why. Right, so the association could begin to move forward on the issue of racial justice. I can just imagine this happening. If anyone was following the recent discussion, voting, infighting about Article 2, you might be able to imagine this. Emotions, hope, betrayal, confusion, all mixed up and intertangled with business meetings. Right? A few years ago, this is the Article 2 thing, a few years ago, our national faith leaders charged a committee. I mean, already I'm like, oh God, a committee, right? They charged a committee with reimagining, redefining our values to create something inspirational, meaningful, grounded in liberation and justice. That was the charge. That's hard to do. The group took on this task. They spent years trying to listen, respond to, incorporate the myriad realities, which is Unitarian Universalism, right? And when their final language was presented, some people were so excited and hopeful, some people were deeply offended, and others didn't care or didn't notice, which is how it will be. Nationally, there were discussions, there were debates, there were forums, feedback sessions, eventually there were votes. And the process was painful. It did not always align with our values. I can only imagine what 1969 felt like, with so many people of color feeling unheard and betrayed enough to leave our faith. The point is that our country, our faith, neither institution is perfect. What? We're not perfect? No, we're not perfect. We may want to put a positive spin or ignore our past mistakes, but only recently are we beginning, as a faith community, to seek out the voices of those people who have historically been excluded. The victors, in our case, were the white people who stayed at the meeting, who were in leadership, who held power over the budget, and so they wrote our history. More recently, Unitarian Universalism is looking at our past with both veneration and critique to see where we made mistakes, what we might do differently moving into the future. And one very powerful voice in the reexamination of Unitarian Universalist history is and racial justice is the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed. He continues to be a vocal teller of truth, where for too long we have remained silent. His many books examine Unitarian Universalist history with regard to especially people of color. And it's difficult and it's important to hear. Reverend Mark Morrison Reed has this to say about the empowerment controversy. It is time to honor the passion, fervor, and commitment to principle of all who were involved and to thank them for caring so deeply. Portraying the empowerment controversy as an institutional failure is short-sighted and misleading. The UUA stumbled and had to, but it also set the scene for women, lesbian and gay people, the disabled, Hispanics, and other marginalized groups in the UUA to speak out, claim their space, and make demands. These identity groups also experienced resistance, but the outcry was neither as prolonged nor as intense. Who today would challenge an oppressed group's right to gather together to explore its identity, formulate a strategy, and take a stance? Never again since 1969 has the UUA Board of Trustees, Nominating Committee, or Commission on Appraisal been without significant African-American representation. Never again would we produce a hymnal or religious education materials without response to African-American experience. The events set in motion by the Black Rebellion traumatized, but also transformed some and educated us all. As Ben Scott said, the tragedy would have been if successive generations had had to continue to struggle the way they did. Unitarian Universalists never stopped trying, reticently, clumsily, episodically. UUs continue to lurch along. I mean, there's truth. That's truth. Euro-Americans have come to see that it is their own racism and cultural illiteracy they are called to address. This is what always needed to happen, but reparation, the giving of $1 million to Black concerns, however noble, was not meant to address that. In fact, money's power to assuage guilt may have delayed this white awakening as much as the ensuing trepidation did. Gene Ott aptly called these events the white controversy over Black empowerment, right? In a denomination that was 99% white, what else could it be? It happened because of the bigotry and mistakes of earlier generations of religious liberals, and change is difficult because middle-class Black UUs needed to redirect the priorities, and this meant for some leaving. These were all good people, torn by competing loyalties and conflicting values, some of which ran counter to their deepest tradition of polity and individualism. It happened because of institutional immaturity, fear, and hubris. It happened because it had to happen. Wow. So this is more history than I intended when I first started doing this. I was like, this is a lot more history, but it's with a point. It's worth a point. Only when we view the past both with reverence and with critique can we have a better view of what's necessary for a better future. I could go on and on. I mean, I could keep going on about this topic, researching histories that have been literatively, figuratively whitewashed by those who are in power. Instead, I want to give you each a challenge. That's why I start broad. I keep getting closer and closer. Look at your own families. Look at your own lives, right? What in my past am I not proud of? Where might I feel a bit of shame? Did my ancestors own slaves? Have my relations benefited from others' disadvantage? What institutional or societal privilege got me where I am today, and who may have been at a disadvantage? Take these questions as they are. Take them for yourself, and not as blame, but as opportunities for introspection. Very difficult beginnings for self-knowledge. is when we see where our families, where ourselves have fallen short, then what do we do? What next? What next? With difficult knowledge, what do we do? Columbus helped to bring European people and culture to the American continent. So we can laud and thank him for that. We can also see in the pain, the death, the destruction which he brought, and learn about what a sense of divinely given power and privilege can do, and how harmful that can be. We should not ignore his legacy, just as we need to make concerted efforts to rise up and see the truths and the histories of those who are on the other side of his exploration, right? The celebration of indigenous people pushes our country to recognize the past failures while also heightening understanding and celebration of formerly forgotten cultures. In our faith, we recognize the pain and harm which was caused by a mainly white faith movement trying to do good in the world. Not only do I recognize that pain, but we try to assuage it, respond to it, and possibly heal the brokenness and the pain which we caused. Institutionally, the UUA board recently pledged over $5 million to Black Lives UU as one small effort at restitution. Now, money is not the only way, sometimes not the best way, sometimes not a good way at all. The ongoing pain is one reason. Keep this in mind. This is one reason that in Unitarian Universalist communities, you may experience efforts to decentralize white voices, to name privilege, to work in new, challenging, and different ways, especially during business meetings. Now, I end by recognizing the picture that's been behind me, and I haven't spoke about at all during the whole time. Does anyone know what this is or have any idea? It looks like the goose and the golden egg. There is an egg and a bird. I'll give you that, but that's it. This is a portrayal of the Sankofa bird. And Sankofa is a symbol from Ghana, which speaks to learning from and listening to our past. This bird is depicted in many different depictions with its feet pointed forward. Let me make sure. Its feet pointed forward and its head pointed back. Its head turned backward, often picking up an egg. It's showing that you can move forward, move into the future, informed by the past. Informed by the past, but also picking up, taking with you what is important, what is valuable, what lessons were learned, what wisdom gained. The knowledge of our past must never be forgotten. We can take wisdom from both the amazing and the terrible. That's our charge. That's our charge, to be like the Sankofa bird. And it's not an easy one, right? It's not an easy one. To look to the past with reverence, to look to the past with humility, with critique, and then to create a future informed by that past. So be the Sankofa. Use your wisdom to help heal the world, to help heal yourself and your communities. Amen and amen. And let us now sing this inspirational song written about the journey of Unitarians and Universalists and see how it might inform our lives. You may rise in body or in spirit for hymn number 145, As Tranquil Streams.
As tranquil streams that meet and merge. We are a fellowship, a community with friendship and relationship at its heart. We hold love and care for each other as the burning ember of our purpose. We embody the importance of care for each other every week as we set aside time for sharing the matters of the heart. If you have a sorrow or joy which overflows into this beloved community, I invite you to come forward and share briefly into the microphone. Those of you online can raise your hand and you will be unmuted if you want to share. And please begin with your name. I'm going to share a brief meditative poem. So if you feel inclined, please close your eyes and get comfortable. And we'll meditate on these words. This poem is called A Great Silence. And we can think about the silence within ourselves and sit with it and hopefully find peace. Shades of quiet, gradations of solitude. Winter colors, some cool blue, some warm as the light from the hearth that emanates into the snow as the door is opened. A great silence lives within each quiet. Hues of deepening solitude, washes of emotion and thought. We jump from one to the next, stepping stones across a dark swirl of impulses. Each quiet holds familiar sounds. The morning brings only the ticking of a clock, occasional passing cars, perhaps a plane overhead. Evening, the house settles and creaks, animal noises, whispering winds. Color and sound continually divide the senses, reflecting a dichotomy within human nature. Awareness heightens acutely, then wanes. And then we draw the coverlet of night about us in preparation to dream beneath the moon's white. Thank you.
We generally bring our time of sharing to close with a song, and as we often do, today we will sing Spirit of Life, which is hymn number 123 in the hymnal. The words and music are by Carolyn McDade. And
we end our time as we usually do with more song. And I do like singing. So if you wish, you may rise in body or in spirit for 149. Lift every voice and sing. You do have to stay alert when we have lyrics on the screen and hymnals, because that was two today that had different numbers of verses. So thank you for being alert and aware and ready. I end with these words from the hymn we sang earlier. Actually, this is the verse we didn't sing. It's that fourth verse. Prophetic church, the future waits your liberating ministry. Go forward in the power of love. Proclaim the truth that makes us free. Amen and blessed be.